Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
When I'm writing an opera, I have to find a musical universe in which all those characters can live so that the music is of a piece, even though they each have their individuality. For the longest time, I didn't know where it came from. And it's a four-chord theme. It's just this. I'll do it down here. Just those four chords. And it just has this feel of rise and fall. There's a yearning to it, just those four chords. And from that, and throughout the opera, it appears in many, many different permutations.
It's the most famous novel no one's ever read. There was something we were changing slightly in the book, so we would always come back to this. It's the most famous novel no one's ever read, so don't worry about it.
You know, if Melville had been writing an opera, he would have written it differently. He was writing a novel. And what we're doing is writing an opera based on his brilliant work. And so in order to be faithful to the spirit of his piece, which is really what we're trying to do, it's necessary to reinvent it in certain ways, while always being faithful to his intent, and that's what we certainly have tried to do.
This white whale, I mean, it's a white for a reason. I think it sort of represents this supernal god sort of out there that is unknowable and yet sort of wreaks its vengeance upon us. And so there's a deeper meaning in there other than just getting the darn whale for chopping his leg off.
There's the spatial relationship of sound that really speaks to the American soul, the largeness of space. Flying into San Diego, seeing the vastness of Southern California right in front of your face. That sound is encapsulated in harmonies of Copland, Hanson, Hickey, Floyd, Bernstein, all of these things. Not to mention a rhythmic vitality. There's tons of rhythmic vitality in Moby Dick, rhythms that we associate in our daily lives that will speak to you.
I even remember a certain general director, who shall remain nameless, saying to me, "I just don't understand how you're going to do this with, you know, all that water and boats and whales." And I was like, "Have you seen Wagner's Ring Cycle?" You think this is challenging? Was Terrence McNally's idea, and when he suggested it, it was for the Dallas Opera. They were going to open a new opera house, the Winspear Opera House, and Jonathan Pell had asked me, you know, what would you be interested in doing? And so I happened to be in New York, and I asked Terrence, "Well, what would we do?" And he said, "Well, there's only one opera I want to do, and that's Moby Dick." And I went, "Moby Dick." And I thought about it, and I looked in his eye, and I saw this twinkle and this smile, and I knew that it was going to be possible because he's such a great man of the theater.
Terrence didn't finish up doing the libretto.
No, he had to withdraw for personal reasons, unfortunately, but I wound up being able to go to my good friend Gene Scheer, who I'd worked with many times, and Gene is a brilliant wordsmith, and he's got a real poet's soul.
What the composer responds to is ultimately the most significant thing. Obviously, the libretto matters. It matters enormously, but a lot of its function is to inspire music from the composer. And with regard to Lenny, I wrote the libretto, and then I would sit with him and with Jake, and sometimes alone with Lenny, and we would just discuss certain dramaturgical issues. And based on those conversations, I went back and I made changes and so forth. So there was always a back and forth process.
Nothing was written when I became involved. I became involved 3 years before the premiere, before any of the libretto had been written. So it's really just, you know, wanting to take the journey with some people that you respect and like.
It is a collaborative process, and ultimately it's about getting a fantastic score that can communicate the emotional center of a piece.
Because it's now. But so he...
The mistake people make when they're taking something from one form to another is to try to recreate the literary experience, and you can't do that. You have to create a dramatic piece, just the way if you made something into a film, it's a different medium, and so a lot of the advantage you have in opera, and is that you have music that's very often serves as the subtext and for the emotional core of the characters. So you have two ways to get at their core. You have the words, and then you have the music, which goes to people's core and into people's psyches in a way that the spoken word doesn't. I do a lot of big things, and I use projection and film and things like that a lot. I always have to ask myself is if it's serving the story, and if it is storytelling, and that it's not something put on for effect. Very often when I use the largest images and the most complex technology, there's very little being sung on the stage. This is the way it's structured, the way the street piece is structured. It's either really big or really small, and it gets really big and really small, really big and really small, so that we get the context of where these very human stories are happening. And so I am aware of it, because there are times I've gone too far. You know, I've gone too far, and you always go too far, actually. You always go too far, and then you pull it back.
He's obsessed. He's sort of bent on revenge. He's absolutely focused in that direction. And in this opera, there's almost no stepping back from that intensity. He does get a little step back towards the end of the opera, just to show a little bit more of the humanity of him. But generally, he is so focused on hunting Moby Dick that that's what there is about him. Sed in nomine, Starbuck is very definitely the foil. He's the first mate, so his responsibility is to carry out all the orders. And if there is hesitation on the part of Starbuck to get something done, Ahab is very quick to jump all over him and repeat what he said. I said back to work, or whatever. He senses immediately. Ahab senses in Starbuck a lack of support about the mission of hunting this whale, and he confronts him very quickly about that.
Mr. Starbuck, art thou not king for Moby Dick? I came here to hunt whales, sir, not my commander's vengeance. How many barrels will thy vengeance yield on the Nantucket market? My vengeance will fetch a great premium.
Starbuck learns early on that this is no ordinary voyage, that his captain has got some serious flaws, that he's on a mission that is not in the best interest of Starbuck or his crew, And he is not going to let this fly. He is contrary to Ahab from day one and really, really wants them to focus on their mission of harvesting the oil, harvesting the whales, getting back home to Nantucket, where he has a wife and child, which he mentions throughout the opera. And he's really the one character on the ship that you can really see has one foot on land. Even though we have a very strong conflict that's developed in the opera, when we get to the scene, the symphony, in the second act of the opera, you really see that these are two men who share so much in common. And Starbuck realizes an opening to try to get Ahab to really think about the people that he's left at home in Nantucket.
Oh, Captain, grand old heart after all, why should anyone give chase to that hated fish? Let me alter the course, sir. How cheerily, how hilariously would we bowl on our way to see the old Nantucket. My whale boat.
Aye, sir.
And I'll have no man in my boat who isn't afraid of a whale.
Aye, sir.
He's a young man who's searching for himself, searching for who he really is. Throughout the entire production, throughout the entire opera, he is learning about life when really he boards the Pequod to escape life. Thinking that he's not escaping life, but that really is what he's trying to do. He's just a wanderer. So he ends up finding a friend on the boat and realizing there's more to life than nothing. It's interesting that Greenhorn and Queequeg become friends because Queequeg is really sort of the base of me, bass part and vocally, but I mean, a bass in, he's comfortable with who he is, and he really shows Greenhorn the ropes, pun intended, in the sense that Queequeg has been on whaling ships before. Greenhorn has not. Queequeg has seen life. Greenhorn has seen a different aspect of it. And it's not like Greenhorn's naive, but he's not seen the more important things, like family, for example.
What's the figure? Is the dog ahead?
One of the favourite things I like is the unlikely friendship. Lenny has often said that Queequeg is so different that he's often, in a way, intimidates others on the ship, so no one really talks to him. Then you have a Greenhorn who no one talks to. So these kind of these opposites, in a way, just happen to pass. And quite a kind of a combustible nature, actually. Favorite moment in the opera is when he actually wants to come to my island. He actually wants to know about me, which I think on the ship, considering I'm different, the fact that someone even cares enough to say I want to learn your language. I write down every detail. That, to me, personally, as well as Queequeg, the character, is a poignant moment.
If you think about the time period that this book takes place in, the story, the fact that Pip has made it north on his own is nothing short of miraculous. He has no documentation, no parents, no one who can lay claim to him. So I think it's quite fascinating that he even made it north to the Pequod at all, which is the thing that sort of grabbed me about him as a character and fascinated me. Just the strength that he comes with from the onset is a nice place to build a character from. I never want to do anything the same. So, unfortunately, we have a wonderful director that allows us that. That's the wonderful thing about this piece. We explore things together, and he lets you come to the table with your own ideas. And there have been quite a few things that just me exploring in rehearsals, which is my favorite part of my job, that I have found and he's fallen in love with. And he said, let's keep that.
There are difficulties associated with limping around the stage on the peg leg. Your inner core is working very hard to keep yourself stable and moving around the stage, and therefore your interior is kind of tensed up a little bit, and that's exactly the opposite way to what singing is.
To me, it's a process that actually only really comes out when the aesthetic changes. It feels like another person is being painted on in a way. It's livable and breathable and kind of malleable, and so I can do everything that I feel Queequeg wants to do. It's just that it's me inside and it's Queequeg outside. The hair comes off and the tattoos come on, and suddenly even... And backstage, people are looking at me differently. It starts to feel like Queequeg has kind of joined us in a way.
Pad in the right place?
Yes.
You want it to be?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to tighten down the legs.
The beautiful thing about singing suspended in the air is that Jake has... taking the pressure off of me by writing so beautifully and easily in a part of my voice that feels comfortable and at home. The difficult part is sitting on two seatbelts and a wire and singing, because there's absolutely zero sense of gravity or being grounded or anything. So it's really just me being a fearless girl. I just sort of jumped in and I just do it. I like challenges, and so... it was something that I welcomed, and I just jumped right in. It just takes a little bit of practice, and it's, you know, but I am very well aware of every second of the 3 minutes and 11 seconds that I'm on stage.
Our first priority was, first of all, to get the 40 best singers we could. Once we've gotten into production now, Lenny and Couture are great. I mean, they've really sat down with the score and found ways in which the action mirrors the music.
Please, and
Yeah,
we need to get that chord.
And so the actions that we are asked to do actually help us in terms of solidifying our musical learning process and our memorization process. Every move that we make on stage is one that is motivated by what's happening in the score. There's nothing that's kind of against the music. It's magnificent vocal writing.
Swear, death, and then we begin death to Moby. Exactly.
I came in and I taught all the choreography, and I placed the chorus and made sure that the chorus and supers and acrobats were all dialed into what they were doing, so that when Lenny showed up, it was very easy to just get them all together with principles. All of these dances are playful. I think there's a level of tension in the ship that Flask and Stubb pick up on, and between the two of them decide that they're going to sort of mock as well. They're going to make fun of themselves and of the dance tradition. And in that vein, I think those who join in the dance, which is about half the chorus, are coming from a place of play. They're already laughing at Flask and Stubb, and so then they become more comfortable laughing with themselves. There are two other movement elements. There's a huge whaleboat crash, and what happens on the wall is sort of a bird's eye view of the boat as it crashes, and people fall out of it. It's different because they're not falling out of something horizontal, they're falling out of something vertical, and it's just a very different way of looking at physics in order to make this read to the audience.
That is the ocean of
There is a fair amount of block and tackle choreography. There are 12 or 13 practical pulleys on the stage, and we have chorus members at each one of them. And in various times during the show, they pull them in time together. And each one of these sections has a different rhythm to it, and so it takes a massive amount of rehearsal in order to get the rhythms correct.
Oh, Johnny is the king, and the dogger is the whale. Our flourish in his tail. What a fun it's for the game, just say. Jokey, jokey, pokey, pokey, that is the ghost.
A super is a non-paid, non-singing role in the San Diego Opera. They're basically spear carriers. They're functionaries on the stage, so they're chambermaids, family, townspeople, things like that. They get a lot of the action on the stage done, so a lot of action wouldn't happen on the stage if it wasn't for supers. In Moby Dick, we do have two separate groups of supers. One are volunteers. There's about five of them. And then we have 10 paid supers who are acrobats, climbers, professional sailors. So they provide the authenticity to the piece. We have several stunt coordinators who work with the supers. And the volunteer supers also participate in the fights and the choreography.
We have some remarkable supers that are the fighters in this. That there's about 15 guys that do the lion's share of the fighting in the big brawl. These guys are very skilled physically, and because of that, they're able to give the impression of guys that are just, you know, sort of going at each other. So my job was to sort of orchestrate that within the finite boundaries of the set as it's given to me, with the added sort of obstacle of chorus members that are dancing, and the fight breaks out and the chorus members recede from the fight, and you know, it all goes to hell.
Jake has really achieved his voice in this piece. What's so wonderful is the different aspects of his score that accompany this drama. It is very accessible. There are tunes, leitmotifs, tunes that are associated with different emotions and characters that come up through the entire piece. And they are amazingly breathtaking tunes. Now, there is dissonance, of course, just like anything. In any theater, there's something that's discordant. But it's all justified by the drama. There are rhythmic challenges, meter challenges. It's because the drama demands it. It's because that moment in the piece, you need to have something difficult, perhaps, because the moment is difficult. So instead of me stressing about it, I try to engage the drama and figure out, why did the composer do this? What's great, as I get to call him, because he's still alive.
I can't help but wonder if this is going to go down in history as the great American opera. I've never encountered anything like it in the 16 years that I've been closely associated with opera.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.